In the coming week, Taiwan celebrates National Day. North Koreans mark the 75th anniversary of the Workers' Party with a military parade. And the UK and EU face another crucial Brexit deadline. It's October 8th, 2020, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, in the coming week, Taiwan is preparing to celebrate National Day. Now, its President Tsai Ing-wen will give a speech. There's a host of other events taking place. As always, China will be watching very closely, and there's going to be a great deal of concern about how it might or might not mark the occasion. Can you tell us, Jim, what's going to be happening in Taiwan on this day?
Bob thinks speeches, as you mentioned, a military flyover, and some musical performances. National Day is a major celebration in Taiwan. It's also known as Double Ten Day because it's on the 10th day of the 10th month. And it marks the Wuchang Uprising of October 10th, 1911. That's the rebellion that toppled the Qing Dynasty, ending 2,000 years of imperial rule and established the Republic of China. The theme for this year's celebration is 2020, Proud of Taiwan. I believe that President Tsai Ing-wen is going to kick things off with a speech, and then the aforementioned musical performances, flyover of military planes, and there's going to be a special ceremony honoring medical professionals for their service during the COVID-19 pandemic. And of course, as is typical of any national day, there will be fireworks. Now, President Tsai noted in a tweet that the celebration comes as Taiwan has faced great challenges in 2020. The obvious one is the novel coronavirus. And you have to give props to President Tsai and her administration for doing a great job. Now, the United States currently has 650 deaths for every million people in the population. The corresponding number for Taiwan is less than one.
Wow.
Put it differently, there were more cases of coronavirus diagnosed this week in the White House than in all of Taiwan. So the Taiwanese have done a great job facing down COVID-19. But the other big challenge, of course, is growing tension with mainland China. And that's a function of Beijing's increased aggressiveness and a more forward-leaning U.S. policy toward Taiwan. Now, as you know, Bob, since 1979, the United States has followed the so-called One China policy. That has meant that Washington does not have formal diplomatic relations with Taiwan. And meetings between U.S. officials and Taiwanese government officials have always taken place at a relatively low level. So this past August, when Secretary of Health and Human Services Alex Azar visited Taiwan, he was the highest-ranking U.S. official to visit the island in 40 years. That move clearly angered Beijing, which warned the United States not to gravely damage U.S.-China relations. And since then, China has stepped up military activity aimed at intimidating Taiwan. China has sent fighter jets across the so-called midline of the Taiwan Strait, just essentially like an unofficial buffer zone. And it's also conducted missions that have come near Taiwan's southwest coast. And along with this, the Chinese have upped a propaganda campaign aimed at Taiwan and the United States, intimating that China is ready to go to war, if need be, to protect what it calls a core interest. And I'll note just yesterday that the U.S. National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien warned China against trying to take Taiwan by force. So obviously, tensions are a bit high across the Taiwan Strait. I'll just note one final point is that you can expect Taiwan to remain a flashpoint even if former Vice President Joe Biden wins the presidency, because the Biden campaign, like the Trump administration, has been taking a tougher line in terms of how the United States should deal with Taiwan. And I think support for Taiwan in the United States is broadly bipartisan. And that support, if anything, is intensified in the wake of the Chinese crackdown in Hong Kong and other Chinese behavior.
No, it's certainly worth noting the latest string of developments. We talked about it a few weeks ago on the podcast as well. Taiwan's response to COVID has been extraordinary. It's also garnered some positive attention in Europe, especially places like the Czech Republic, which caused a huge rebuke from China. But I'm interested, Jim, in the in how it marks National Day and some of the messaging that comes out, because it doesn't call it Independence Day. It's calling it National Day. There's a great deal of pride in what Taiwan has accomplished separate from China. But it seems like they still walk a very fine line in not trying to assert any sort of independence per se, and are not really recognized as such by hardly any country in the world.
Well, calling it National Day, Bob, is deliberate because Taiwan is not independent. And Taiwan recognizes that if it were to declare its independence, that that would be crossing a very clear red line for Beijing, hence the notion of National Day. But obviously, I think as we've talked about in the podcast before, there is a section of the Taiwanese public that would like to become independent. They see themselves as separate from China and would relinquish the claims that the Republic of China traditionally had for mainland China. But again, they face the reality that Beijing has communicated that Taiwanese independence would violate what it calls its core interest.
And certainly, as we've seen in playing out in, with Hong Kong, you know, its assertion of democracy is only running more counter to the direction mainland China seems to be going. So it's hard to see this situation being smoothed over with any sort of diplomatic path in the near future, at least.
Quite right. Again, from the vantage point of Beijing, the success of democracy in Taiwan and the emergence of democracy in Taiwan is a threat to the very legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party. So it's not just about Taiwan as territory. It's also Taiwan as an alternative model of governance. But Bob, let's head 1,000 miles north of Taiwan and talk about North Korea. In the coming week, North Koreans will be marking the 75th anniversary of the founding of the Workers' Party. Pyongyang looks to be going all out with its celebrations this year, which in North Korea means you have a grand military parade through Pyongyang. Now, the North Koreans have historically used these parades to display advances in military technology and capabilities. Do we have a sense, Bob, as to what this year's celebration may tell us about where things stand in North Korea?
We do have a sense, Jim, because there are people, news agencies, intelligence services, and so forth, that spend a great deal of time keeping an eye on North Korea through satellite footage and other messaging. And parades are, as you say, a very big deal for North Korea, especially parades on anniversaries and especially parades on big round anniversaries like the 75th. So 10-10 is, like for Taiwan, is a big date in North Korea. And the 75th anniversary also coming at a time when North Korea, like many other countries, has been affected pretty severely by coronavirus impacts. It's a country already under intense sanctions and scrutiny anyway, and it wants to use these parades to show that it has not stopped it from advancing its quite potent military. The signs this time around, according to a number of reports I was looking at, indicate missile activity. So they were looking at this training ground as a staging point for the military parades, and they're looking at especially submarine-launched ballistic missiles as potential item to be displayed at the military parade. We have had in recent years other technology that has been revealed deliberately at these parades. And so that's the thinking this time around, given the structures that have been observed at this launching area and the activity around a submersible launcher and so forth, again, according to satellite imagery, Jim. So close eye, you'll see as this parade unfolds, there'll be a great deal of tweeting and reporting going on about what or what not has come forth from North Korea. The country, just to put into context, in recent years, North Korea has shown an ability to launch intercontinental ballistic missiles, including missiles that could reach the United States, much of the mainland United States. It's still not clear about what sort of nuclear payload it could carry. Estimates are that North Korea has as many as 60 nuclear weapons. It's got one of the world's largest conventional militaries, and it also has some other weapons of mass destruction, chemical and biological. All these things are being looked for and looked at very closely as this parade unfolds, Jim.
Do we have any signals about what else may come out of the celebration? And I ask that, Bob, because for a while earlier this year, Chairman Kim was nowhere to be found. There were rumors that perhaps he had died or was incapacitated. Do we have a sense if he is emerged being more visible in North Korea, or is he still sort of been scarce?
That's a really good question, Jim, and that will be another sign. As important as the armaments coming out are, whether the chairman will emerge and what kind of shape he will be in. He did disappear for a while. He then emerged looking none the worse for the wear, according to most of the photographs and some of the intelligence that came out afterwards. But his absence was such, and the duration of it was such, that it really fueled all sorts of speculation. Again, this is an incredibly closed country, maybe one of the world's most closed countries. So it's all about tea leaf reading and other signs, and people tend to get the filter of South Korean scrutiny and their intelligence officials as well. So Kim's shape, Kim's literally how large he is. He battles with his weight, for example, what kind of shape he looks to be in, how much he will be overseeing events and nodding towards the parading troops and armaments is going to be very closely watched. There's been a great deal of talk about shuffles in the upper hierarchy of North Korean leadership, whether his sister, who has emerged as a sort of a leading power figure, will be further on display. Who will be cited alongside Kim in addition to Kim is also going to be something to closely watch, Jim. Jim, I want to take this conversation back over to Europe, where you have a Brexit discussion coming up. It's one of a dwindling few deadlines we're going to face because the end of the year is a hard deadline for Brexit to occur. The question is, what kind of Brexit? And so that's something that the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and EU leaders are going to be discussing on October 15th. So what's the latest, Jim? There's all sorts of talk about a no-deal Brexit suddenly being more of an option.
Bob, it feels sort of like we're trapped in a political equivalent of Groundhog Day. And I wouldn't blame anybody listening to this conversation to say, wasn't this issue already taken care of? And the answer is yes in a way, and also no in a way. Right now, Britain and the European Union are trying to finalize the terms of Britain's divorce from the EU. And to sort of understand what's happening this month, it might help to take a step back. You may recall that Britain formally withdrew from the EU back at the end of January of this year. And that kicked off a so-called transition period that runs through December 31st. That's the hard deadline that you mentioned, Bob. Now, during the transition, the United Kingdom continues to follow the EU's rules, and it has to pay into the EU budget, but it has no voice in EU decisions. So it's sort of like a halfway house before Britain is fully out of the EU. Now, that is a real deadline at the end of the year because the time for when you could have gotten extension of that is already passed. So the two now have to negotiate the terms of their new relationship. And if they don't agree, that's when you're going to get a hard Brexit or crashing out of Brexit. What that means is, at least in terms of trade, relations between Britain and the EU countries will be determined by the World Trade Organization rules. And that would be very disruptive because they're quite different in terms of things like tariffs and the like in what we currently have. It's also important because reverting to WTO standards wouldn't settle all the outstanding issues between Britain and the EU. It's about more than trade. Now, we have this October 15th deadline. It's not a real deadline in any practical sense. It's one that Prime Minister Boris Johnson of Great Britain has imposed, presumably because he thinks it gives him leverage. But the reality is the two sides really do need to come to some sort of agreement pretty soon, because whatever agreement is struck has to be translated into formal legal text. That legal text has to be translated into all EU languages, and there are a lot of them. And then that agreement has to be ratified by all the governments in the EU as well as in Great Britain. Now, there's a lot of haggling going on, pretty complex. There are really sort of two issues I'll note here. The first is that Prime Minister Johnson wants to walk back parts of the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol. That's the part of the withdrawal agreement that he signed in January. And essentially, that agreement put a customs barrier in the Irish Sea, that is a customs barrier between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK. Now, that's what Theresa May, Johnson's predecessor, had stoutly refused to do. In some sense, it was the Gordian knot that was blocking Britain's formally leaving the EU. And Johnson basically solved the problem by doing what May had refused to do. Now he wants a do-over, and he wants to change that. The EU says this breaks international law. Essentially, their argument is you can't sign an international treaty and then proceed to do things that break that treaty. This has had consequences for Britain's relations with the United States or certain parts of the American political system, because this change in the Northern Ireland Protocol is viewed by many Americans, as well as many people in Ireland, both sides of the border, as posing a threat to the Good Friday Agreement. You recall that's the agreement negotiated back in 1998 to end the troubles in Northern Ireland. And the fear is that if a border is set between Ireland and Northern Ireland, that is going to lead to a return of violence in Northern Ireland.
And that's a rather deeply felt position on the U.S. side, right? I mean, it's fairly bipartisan that no matter what administration we see emerging from the election this year, there's a strong feeling about that agreement.
Very much so. I mean, there are a number of people on both sides of the aisle on Capitol Hill who have been strong supporters of the Good Friday Agreement are very worried about what's going to happen. So Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi has spoken on this. The Chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee has spoken on it. And I will note that Joe Biden, candidate for president, has said bluntly that if he becomes president, that any talk of a trade deal between the United States and Britain is going to depend upon the Johnson government's willingness to adhere to the Good Friday Agreement. So we have that percolating along. There's another issue I just want to mention briefly because we talked about it earlier this year, and that has to do with the status of fishing after Britain leaves the European Union. And in a nutshell, what Britain wants is full access to the European market to sell its fish there. European Union says that's fine, but if we're going to do that, you have to give us access to British waters for our fishing fleets. And London has said that that is unacceptable because once it leaves the European Union, the United Kingdom will be an independent state and it can't give access or unfettered access to the European Union. Now, I'll note that the fishing industry in Britain is actually quite small. It makes up less than 0.1% of the UK's economy and employs even less of Britain's workforce. But fishing communities in Britain are suffering a lot over the years. They're very politically active. In some sense, they punch above their weight, and they are really pushing the government in London to hold fast. As you can imagine, they're playing up historical nationalism and the whole issue of sovereignty, which, of course, was an issue that drove Brexit in the first place.
And there's been a fairly large depletion of fisheries, too, especially the cod fisheries, I think. So it's a hugely symbolic issue, if nothing else.
It's hugely symbolic, but it's also politically important. As you know, in politics, oftentimes the squeaky wheel gets the grease. So we're going to see how they're going to get around this. I should note that pressure in the EU to hold fast on this is probably led by the government of President Emmanuel Macron of France. Now, again, the French fishing industry is small, but it is politically powerful, and it too is sort of, you know, putting pressure on Paris to hold fast here. So we'll see who blinks, if anyone does, at the end of the day. Bob, as listeners may have noticed, that we have brought back the audience figure of the week poll on Twitter. Listeners can vote in the poll, or if they want, they can tweet us each week to decide a notable figure that you and I will discuss on the podcast. This week, the audience figure of the week is 10% of the world infected. Tell us why this is a figure of the week, Bob.
Jim, at a time of ongoing pandemic, the infection, of course, refers to COVID-19, the coronavirus. And this is a figure that WHO experts came up with, extrapolating from data they say is their best estimate at a true figure of global infection. So we have an official infection rate of like 36 million cases and climbing around the world. They say, you know, it's actually maybe 20 times higher. So, and that would put it at 10% of the world's population. It's another round figure that's just sort of marking the mounting toll. We have 1 million global deaths. The U.S., of course, is continuing to grapple with another surge in cases, actually, and a national debate that figures to play a role in the upcoming presidential election. We saw it featured front and center at the vice president debate just last night between Mike Pence and Kamala Harris. And the U.S. has 7.5 million cases, 212,000 estimated deaths, a daily caseload that is back in almost at the level it was in the summertime, and a national debate that continues to play out amidst a lack in strategy. On that latter point, I would just mention that it just so happens today, the Council on Foreign Relations released a independent task force report on preventing another pandemic, but it first of all lays the groundwork for what happened in response to the current one, and it calls the U.S. response deeply flawed. It points out all sorts of ways in which the government dropped the ball in terms of being able to respond, pointing out how other countries have dealt with it. You mentioned Taiwan earlier, Jim. South Korea is another standout case. And also, as these reports do, it also laid out, you know, what is the best path forward for both dealing with this pandemic and future ones, because it, as it states, and there are a lot of senior health experts that were involved in informing this report, there will be absolutely future pandemics. How is the country going to deal with them? What are the tripwires set up to detect them? What are the ways in which the country should be responding? How are medical officials going to be able to take the lead in directing policy? I should also note another big round figure. The World Bank had come come up with its estimate on poverty levels and severe poverty levels, and its highest figure ever, it projected 100 to 150 million people thrown into severe poverty because of the coronavirus. That's the highest level since it started measuring these things in 1990, I believe. So a whole bunch of data out there showing, you know, very negative trend lines, Jim, and 10% of the world is an ominous figure, but it feels right to a lot of people around the world who have been affected by this.
Bob, I think it's, you know, worth emphasizing that the coronavirus has been a big story here in the United States, but it's also been a big story elsewhere around the world. And as you point out, countries have varied tremendously in their ability to handle and ward off the spread of the virus. Clearly, the United States has not been one of the successful countries, but a number of other countries have been equally unsuccessful. I'm thinking of Brazil, for example, Russia. You know, we're seeing resurgence again in parts of Europe. So this has proven to be a very difficult situation for governments to handle. And I'll note that, you know, one of the themes of the council report, which people can find on CFR.org, is that there have been multiple national responses, but very little in the way of coordinated multinational responses to the coronavirus, even though it's pretty clear that coordinated multilateral action would be much more effective. And what was really striking to me, Bob, and I hadn't realized it before reading the report, is that something on the order of 40 new infectious diseases affecting human beings have emerged over the last several decades, which is why the report is so concerned that we are unprepared, because it is likely that the novel coronavirus is not the last time we're going to face the emergence of a new infectious disease that could disrupt our lives.
No, it's a good point. I would also note our colleague, Stuart Patrick, who's one of the co-authors of the report, along with Tom Boyke, another CFR fellow, has a blog post today that accompanies the report's release. And he, among other things, he mentions, you know, the importance of, despite their many, many problems and their competition globally, the U.S. and China need to find common cause on battling this and future pandemics. Stuart noted that even during the height of the Cold War, the U.S. and Soviet Union were able to work together on helping to eradicate things like polio. And so China, although obviously being the country that where the virus originated, where it was allowed to proliferate before it truly became transparent about its spread and its cause, there still needs to be a way where the U.S. and China can work together as opposed to demonizing each other. And that's going to be a very hard road for whoever is sitting in the White House come January.
Well, I certainly hope that the report is widely read and steps are taken. However, there's one sobering part of the report, which it notes that it's been at least two decades now through which there have been repeated strategies, commissions, and reports warning people that we were at risk of a new global pandemic. And many countries, including the United States, didn't take the steps they needed to, even though they recognized the problem they were likely to face. And that's sort of disturbing going forward, because you have to worry that now, even though we know it can happen, will we actually summon the political will to take the steps to get the kind of coordination that you're definitely going to need, for the simple reason that viruses travel. They don't stay home. That's the reason why coordinated efforts matter. If you solve it in one place but don't solve it somewhere else, it's likely to spread.
Now, that was an interesting point of the report. For me, I was hearing echoes a little bit of the 9/11 Commission report about all the steps that had been taken and the coordination that actually did exist prior to the 9/11 attacks, and that it's, you know, one of its damning lines was a failure of imagination by officials to take the steps needed to try to thwart that kind of attack. In this case, it's if you're going to encapsulize the task force report, it's more of like a failure of will to sort of see through the efforts that had been hashed over for so long, as you say, Jim. If what we've just experienced over the last 7 or 8 months is not going to prod action, it's hard to see what will. But we can always hope and pull together and hope for some global action. But Jim, I want to go over to you and see who or what is your figure of the week.
Bob, my figure of the week is a number, and it's 360. That is a number of people who, as of yesterday, had died in renewed fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh. That's the Armenian-dominated enclave inside of Azerbaijan. Now, Armenia and Azerbaijan fought a brutal war back in the early 1990s over Nagorno-Karabakh. That war ended in 1994 with the Armenians in control of most of the enclave and some surrounding Azeri territory. And there has been no reconciliation either with within Azerbaijan or between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the last quarter century. And I should note that this conflict has an ethnic dimension, but it also has a religious one as well. Armenia is majority Christian, Azeris are majority Muslim. And last month, fighting broke out once again. Now, Turkey, which is a NATO member, has publicly sided with Azerbaijan. And Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has said that Turkey will stand with the Azeris until they achieve victory. Now, this is in line with Turkey's much more assertive foreign policy in recent years. And the Turks have been accused of not just providing rhetorical support to Azerbaijan, but actually helping foreign fighters from the Turkish-controlled parts of Syria to make their way to Azerbaijan to join the fighting. This is a charge that has been denied by Ankara. Here I have to note the role of history. More than 1.5 million Armenians were killed in the waning days of the Ottoman Empire and initial years of the Turkish Republic in what has been labeled a genocide, a charge that the Turkish government bitterly denies. Now, Russia, for its part, has good relations with Azerbaijan, but it probably has even better relations with Armenia. Both Armenia and Azerbaijan are former Soviet states, and obviously Moscow is likely to be concerned about instability on its southern flank. We also have Iran with an interest in what is transpiring. Iran shares a border with Azerbaijan. Some of Iran's northern villages have actually been struck by stray shelling from the fighting that is happening there. Now, U.S., French, and Russian diplomats are meeting to try to jumpstart a process to try to defuse the situation. The three countries are the co-chairs of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe's Minsk Group. This is the standing group that has been responsible for trying to sort of cool down this conflict. It hasn't made all that much success, which is part of Turkey's complaint that the OSCE hasn't done enough and the Turks want to have a place at the table. As I think we've discussed in the podcast in the past, Turkey and France have their own set of issues, which further complicates this. So this is a conflict worth keeping an eye on because it could get a lot worse. And for those people who are interested, you can go to the Council's Global Conflict Tracker, which provides a lot more background on the conflict and what is transpiring as things have now heated up again.
Yeah, it's a good call on that one, Jim. Again, one of the world's forgotten or so-called frozen conflicts has heated up again, a number of them on the periphery of the former Soviet Union, a number of them in which Russia tends to play a role. And we're sort of seeing a moment in which former Soviet states are going through a great bit of turmoil. If you add to Azerbaijan and Armenia, Belarus, which has ongoing very large protests against the rule of Lukashenko, as we've discussed, as well as Kyrgyzstan, which is at the moment, as we speak, dealing with a power vacuum after opposition forces helped overturn the results of flawed elections there. So 30 years after after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, all is not well in the former Soviet sphere, Jim.
I imagine they're burning the midnight oil in the Kremlin these days, given all the instability in the former Soviet republics. But what about you, Bob? Who or what is your figure of the week?
Jim, my figure is a person, and his name is Nikos Mikhalolaikos, excuse the pronunciation. He is the head of the Golden Dawn movement, and he, along with 17 former party lawmakers, were all found guilty of crimes, including murder, attempted murder, assault, possession of weapons, and so forth, in a very long trial, lasted more than 5 years. It was seen as an important moment for Greece, for its sort of the institutions of democracy there, because Golden Dawn had been in a sort of an unheard of development about 10 years or so ago. Golden Dawn emerged as a member of parliament, far-right movement in which there was neo-Nazi membership, in some cases open admiration for Adolf Hitler's Nazi movement. And yet at the end of the day, when this party was, especially when it was in power or when it was serving in parliament, there's no longer any members serving in parliament, it was found to be openly supporting murder and assault and violence and so forth against people who were speaking out against it, rallying against it, and so forth. It emerged during this really troubled period, recent period for Greece, which was its debt crisis. And while the country's not out of the woods by any means, it is sort of trying to patiently put together the pieces and also deal with extremist fringes. And it seems to have done so in this case. The group also fed off of anti-immigrant sentiment. And while that has not subsided wholly in Greece, Greece is still I would say on a whole, acting remarkably measured in its dealing with immigrants, given the number that are on its various islands and that are seeking to transit Greece into the EU.
Do we have a sense, Bob, that Golden Dawn is now finished as an organization in Greece, or is it likely to morph into something else?
That's a really important question. We're going to see next in this case is the sentencing. So we'll see what kind of sentences Mikolaikos and others in the movement are given, what sort of response that triggers. The announcement of the trial's conclusion drew a whole bunch of people out into the streets, especially leftists and far leftists in Greece. And again, while it was treated as across the sort of mainstream political spectrum in Greece as a triumph for democracy, there is a great deal of concern in Greece, as in elsewhere in Europe, about the resilience and the ability of the far right to rise, especially on questions over immigration and sort of nationhood. And so I think they're not going to be able to sort of rest on this decision, but going to have to keep a vigilant eye because, again, this issue is unresolved. There are many, many people trying to enter Europe who are coming from war-torn countries, who are from different ethnic, religious, and other backgrounds. And that is running counter to the grain of a lot of people who feel like their countries are under siege. Greece is no exception. So I think as long as that continues, this is something that's going to be sort of lurking as a potential problem. And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. The United States marks Indigenous Peoples Day, and Tajikistan and Northern Cyprus hold presidential elections.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Special thanks to Anna Shortridge, Kara Jackson, and Kendall Ross for their assistance. This week, our recording engineer was Zoe Collins. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrera and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and be safe out there.